Welcome to the last seminar in this series on security of software. And for the last talk, it's an immense pleasure and honor to have Frank Pissens as a speaker. So Frank Pissens is a professor at Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium. And he's a leader of the Distrinet Group, which is an amazing research group, well concerned with security, but very broadly speaking, and with a view that ranges from formal semantics to microarchitecture and kind of low level processor design details. We saw actually some of his work with De Vries and Patrignani on fully abstract compilation in last week. But today he's going to talk about kind of the other end of the spectrum, what happens within the processor when things are being executed speculatively, and what kind of risks and this entails. So thank you very much, Frank.
Thank you very much. So good morning to everyone. And first, let me thank Professor Leroy for inviting me. It's certainly an honor for me to give this seminar at the Collège de France. So I will talk about a quite recent class of attacks against software, transient execution attacks, and how to defend against them. And I think this will actually nicely build on several topics that were covered earlier in this course, including, for instance, cache attacks, logical isolation and isolation mechanisms in general, information flow security, and so forth. So all these will come back in today's lecture. I also know that earlier lectures have briefly mentioned Spectre, one of the most prominent transient execution attacks. So the objective of this seminar is to go a bit deeper. So I hope it will give you the necessary background to understand transient execution attacks and defenses in depth. And I will use programming language-based methods, so methods from the programming language research community to study these transient execution attacks. So that's the plan. So that leads to the following outline for my talk. So I'll first do a brief introduction. Transient execution attacks are only 5 years old, yet they're already quite impactful, and I want to illustrate this a little bit in the introduction. And then we'll start building models. So I'll have to propose a model for a processor instruction set, and we'll try to keep it as simple as possible, but of course there should be enough to illustrate the attacks that we want to study. I'll have to model out of order and speculative execution, which is the main feature of a processor that these transient execution attacks exploit. And a particular challenge will be to model the attacker in a sufficiently simple way, and yet in a sufficiently powerful way. Okay, so I'll also spend a bit of time on that. And once all that is in place, we have a model with which we can look at examples of both transient execution attacks and defenses against them. So that's a bit the plan for today. So as an introduction, so the kind of systems for which transient execution attacks matter are what I would call shared platforms. And so what I mean with that is a shared platform is a processor, maybe together with some system software, that runs code, that runs software from multiple stakeholders, where these stakeholders do not necessarily trust one another, right? So this is extremely common. The most prototypical example would be the cloud. You might have your virtual machine running on a processor in the cloud, and on that same processor, there will be virtual machines from other customers that you might not even know. So definitely multiple stakeholders, and you do not necessarily trust them. But a similar thing happens, for instance, in a browser. The browser will be running maybe WebAssembly code or JavaScript code from many origins, and these different origins do not necessarily trust one another. So this is the kind of system for which the attacks we'll look at today matter. Of course, on such a system, you will have mechanisms to limit interference between these various stakeholders. And actually, I think you covered several examples of these mechanisms in earlier lectures in this course. So think about things like process isolation, virtual machines, enclaved execution, software-based isolation, and so forth. So we will assume that the system has some mechanism in place to limit interference between between the code from multiple stakeholders. It doesn't matter too much what kind of mechanism is used. So you can think of process isolation as the default. And if we need anything else, I will emphasize that. So then what are microarchitectural attacks? So that's the superclass of transient execution attacks. So here you see a picture of the system model again. So we have two stakeholders, and we'll call him one of the stakeholders an attacker and the other one a victim, right? So they're both running code on this shared platform. We'll assume that that code is programmed in machine code. So we're at the binary level or assembly code, whatever you want to call it. So programmed against some processor instruction set. And that is instruction set is specified in an instruction set architecture specification. And at that level of abstraction, at the level of abstraction of the instruction set architecture, the attacker and the victim, or more generally, the various stakeholders, will be fully isolated from one another. For instance, using virtual machine isolation or process isolation or whatever mechanism you want to consider. So the state that these programs have at the level of abstraction of the instruction set architecture will be separate, right? They don't share. So for simplicity, we will consider the case where they don't share any architectural state. You might have intermediate situations where there is some sharing, but that's not essential for this talk. But then, of course, this instruction set, this machine code, this assembly language is implemented by a processor, which is itself a complex beast. It is millions and millions of lines of hardware description language. And that implementation will also internally use state, typically to improve the efficiency, the performance with which it can execute the instructions from this instruction set architecture. And examples are things like caches that you discussed, or branch predictors, or all kinds of buffers that the CPU, that the processor might use. And that, let's say, implementation level state, that we'll call that the microarchitectural state, is on most processors shared between these various stakeholders. And so the class of microarchitectural attacks, which is a superclass of the attacks we look at today, studies the kind of problems that brings, right? So can an attacker, relying on the fact that there is all this shared microarchitectural state, learn something about the victim? Can he extract secrets out of the victim program state and so forth? So this is, of course, a known problem. Microarchitectural attacks by themselves are old. Instances of them have been known for at least 15, probably more than 20 years. So for instance, you covered these cache attacks in an earlier lecture, and they're a good example of this class of microarchitectural attacks. And we also, let's say up to 2018, understood countermeasures relatively well. And you can have countermeasures at the hardware level, or you can have countermeasures at the software level, which is probably most relevant for this course. So for example, you covered in earlier lectures the constant time programming discipline, which is a countermeasure to make sure that victim secrets will not leak across these classic microarchitectural side channels like cache side channels. So up to 2018, things looked good. There were leaks, but we understood them and we had an idea of how we could handle them. But then in 2018, transient execution attacks appeared, and several of them were actually found and disclosed in parallel by multiple teams across the world. So the first three were Spectre, Meltdown, and Foreshadow. They were all found in 2017 and publicly disclosed in 2018. And they kind of changed the game for these microarchitectural attacks. They showed how this feature of speculative and out-of-order execution that we'll look at in more detail later significantly amplifies this problem of microarchitectural attacks. And unfortunately, we also noticed over the past 4 to 5 years that this is not a small, simple bug in a processor somewhere that can easily be fixed. Many other variants of these transient execution attacks followed. So you may have heard names like Riddle, Zombie Load, Fallout, LVI, and so forth. New ones are being discovered even this year. Also, a broad variety, and also the impact of these attacks on academia and industry have been quite huge. And I want to take the next two slides to briefly illustrate these two points. So first, the breadth of the problem, and second, the impact that the problem has had. So first, on the breadth of the problem, what I'm showing on this slide here, this classification tree is a classification tree from the paper you see here. Actually, it's the extended version that's being maintained at this website. And I don't want to go into the details of this classification tree. I'm just showing it to show you the breadth of the problem. So in this tree, each leaf, each of these red leaves, represents one specific variant of a transient execution attack. So this gives you an indication that this is a class of problems, a category of problems, not a single problem that we need to solve. It's more like, let's say, memory safety vulnerabilities and attacks, which is also a broad class of problems rather than a single simple bug. So that's one point. Second, on impact. Impact, even though these attacks are only 5 years old by now, impact on academia and industry has been huge. So to illustrate academic impact, here you see again the three first papers. So they're like 4 years old now. And they've been cited jointly over 4,000 times. So I think that shows academic interest. I think that's also an indication that there are interesting problems underneath these vulnerabilities. But also on the industry side, when I looked in 2021, so this is numbers from a year old, in the time frame 17-21, there were more than 30 CVEs related to transient execution attacks. And the amount of effort that companies like Intel, AMD, ARM, but also system software companies like Microsoft or the Linux kernel developers, for instance, the amount of effort that they have invested, let's say, in the first 2 years after discovering these attacks into getting things secure again or secure enough again is really impressive and significant. So the impact has been huge. However, maybe partly as a consequence of that, the first 2 years also have been a bit chaotic, very productive. I mean, many things have been found and defenses have been rolled out quickly, but they've also not been very structured or foundational or systematic. I mean, we've seen academics compete to find vulnerabilities first, also security researchers from industry compete to find new vulnerabilities first. We've seen companies a bit scared of these vulnerabilities and trying to have very long embargoes so that they have time to fix their systems and protect their customers. We've seen very quick but ad hoc countermeasures that were deployed and then broken soon thereafter. So it's been a bit of chaotic. But I think this class of vulnerabilities is important enough that we should give it a systematic foundational study. And there's actually now an entire community of researchers looking at these questions. How should we model processors to reason about these vulnerabilities, about the attacks that exploit them, about the countermeasures that defend against them? How can we formalize the security objectives for these defenses, these countermeasures? So this is a whole field now. And this seminar will give kind of an introductory view to the language-based school in this field. And I should emphasize that this is work by many people. So I'm not talking about my own work here. I did a small fraction of the things I'll talk about. This seminar is based on many papers, and I cited some of the most important ones here. And these are also good sources that you can go to if it turns out that I don't give you enough detail in this seminar. Of course, you're also welcome to ask questions to me at the end of the seminar. Okay, so that's our plan. So let's start building these models that we can use to study these attacks more foundationally. And I'll start with a simple instruction set architecture model. So think of it as a simple assembly language model. So we'll simplify to the maximal extent possible. So we'll have a finite set of register names, and we'll freely use any name we want. A real processor typically has a very small set of registers like R0, R1, X0, X1, or whatever. We'll use any name we want. We just have some finite set of registers. The values that so we think of this instruction set as a programming language, obviously, and the values that this programming language manipulates will be natural numbers. Again, we could turn this into fixed width bit strings, like 64-bit numbers, for example, without any fundamental impact. So for simplicity, I'll pick natural numbers. I should emphasize the set of registers here that the program counter that will treat it separately. That's also a non-essential choice, but it will simplify some things further down the line. And then we can build arbitrary expressions on these registers and values, and we'll use whatever arithmetic or logical operators that we want. when we use logical operators, we'll use the standard representation of Booleans, where false is represented as the number zero and true is represented as the number one. And then we can have instructions, and five instructions will be sufficient for our instruction set architecture. First, we'll have an assignment instruction. So what this does is it has an expression here. And so the instruction computes the value of this expression and stores it in register R. Then we have load store instructions that will go to memory. So they both compute an address. E will evaluate to a number that's interpreted as a memory address. And then load will get the contents of that address and put it in a register, and store will do the other way around. And then finally, we need control flow instructions. So we'll have a computer jump. So this expression here will compute a code address, and execution will continue at that address. Whereas this instruction is a conditional branch, it will jump to a fixed address. So this is a value, not an expression, based on whether a register is zero or not. So if the register is zero, the branch is taken, and otherwise it falls through, right? So I hope this is simple enough. This is a simplification of instruction set architectures that you will know. A program will then be a list of instructions, and code addresses like we use here are just indices in that list. Okay, so just to illustrate, here's a very simple example program. So this will compute the sum of the first two elements of array A, where the A is an address held in a register. So you can see the machine code here. So we compute the while condition. If it's false, we jump to the end of the program, beyond the snippet that we're looking at here. And while it's true, we will execute the body and jump back, right? So no surprises here, I think. I hope you can read code like this easily. So if we would execute this in a state, so for instance, if the initial state would be a state where all registers are zero, so here you see all the registers used by this program, and in a state where memory contains in the first two addresses these two numbers, then this, since A is address zero, this would be the first two elements of the array A, and this program would compute the sum of nine. I hope that is relatively obvious. I also hope that it is relatively straightforward to see that we can define an operational semantics for this language using standard language-based techniques. So I'll give you the formal definition of the program states, and then the semantics will be a transition system, and I'll just explain the transition system by example, and I'll leave it up to you to come up with the inference rules, or you can look them up in the papers that I cited. So program state is also quite simple. It consists of a memory, which will just be a list of values, and indices in this list will be addresses, data addresses that we use in load and stores, and a register bank row, which is just a mapping from this finite set of register names to values. So it assigns a value to every register. And then, as I mentioned, we will treat the program counter separately just because it will be convenient for some of the things we do. So I hope you see that this leads to a transition system. So given an initial state, for instance, one where all registers are zero and where we are given a memory, and given a program, we can define a transition system that defines how program states will evolve over time. And I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. So for instance, let's look at the first transition. If the program counter is zero, we look at the first instruction in memory, the zeroth instruction in memory. We compute this expression. This is I is zero, so this is true. So this will be the number one, right? And we assign that to R0. And so that is the transition taken when we start from this state with this program. So at that point, the program counter will be one. So then we have to execute this instruction here. So this would jump to six if R0 would be zero, but it's not. So we just fall through the branch and the program counter gets updated and all the rest stays the same. And that's how we go to this state here. And let's do one more. So this next instruction at address two is a load. So we will compute the address, which will be A plus I, which is zero. So we look in memory at address zero, we find the number five here. So that's what we will put in the register R0. And so we see here the execution of the second instruction of this program. And we can continue this, it would get boring soon, so I'm not gonna do that. But you see that at the end, indeed the sum of 9 has been computed as we expect. So this is very, very standard semantics, I would say, of a very, very simple programming language. Keep in mind that we're still thinking about these shared platforms where we have multiple stakeholders, but the language that we provide here, the code of a single stakeholder will be programmed in this language. And if we have multiple stakeholders, they will have completely separated program states, separate memory, separate register banks, separate program counters, and so forth. So at the level of abstraction of this programming language, the multiple stakeholders really cannot interfere with one another. They have even no way to talk about one another, right? So they're completely isolated. So then, of course, you might wonder, how can we then reason about the attacks that we want to reason about? Well, that's a good question, and we'll come back to that, right? But at the moment, let's not worry about that. Let's first worry about modeling the main feature that our attacks will exploit, which is out of order and speculative execution. So what's the basic idea of out of order and speculative execution? So the basic idea is the following. So this is the high level view. We'll dive in a bit more details in a minute. So rather than, like we did in the base semantics I just discussed, executing one instruction at a time in a single step, what we want to do in out of order and speculative execution is speed things up by fetching many instructions at the same time. Right? So we will fetch many instructions into a buffer in the CPU. We call that the reorder buffer. And the instructions that have been fetched and are in the processor will be called in-flight instructions that are currently in the process of being executed. From that buffer, the processor can execute instructions out of order if it wants to, possibly in parallel. The idea is that this might speed things up. One very slow instruction doesn't have to cause delays for later instructions in the program. That's the basic idea. So when we execute these instructions in the buffer, we execute them and keep the results in the buffer. So the buffer are not yet visible to software at that point. So they're being executed in the processor implementation, in a sense, still hidden from software. But at some point, we will commit the effect of instructions to the architectural state. And at that point, we can think of the instructions as actually being fully executed. Right? So that's the big idea. We'll dive into details in a minute. I just want to point out one more thing. In order to do this, to execute this big idea, we may need prediction and speculation. For example, when I say here fetch many instructions, that's easier said than done, in the sense that if we fetch instructions and we arrive at a branch, we don't know yet whether the branch will be taken or not, or if it's a computed branch, we don't know where it will go. Right? So we can't just fetch many instructions. We would have to stop at any control flow instruction. So processors deal with that by predicting things. And one of the things they'll predict is where a branch will go, for example. And so you'll see that also in the semantics that we'll discuss. Of course, this will also require a mechanism to handle mispredictions. And it's actually that, the handling of misprediction, that leads to the transient execution attacks that we'll talk about today. Okay, so let's try to model this mechanism of out of order and speculative execution in a bit more detail. So what I'll do is I'll refine the instruction set semantics that we looked at by also modeling part of this microarchitectural state that's responsible for out of order and speculative execution. So you see here the extended program state. We still have memory, register bank, program counter, and we now have, in addition, this reorder buffer that I mentioned. And on pictures, I will show the architectural state in white and the microarchitectural state in gray, right? So that you can easily keep them separate. So what is this reorder buffer semantically? The reorder buffer is just a finite list of in-flight instructions, right? And what are in-flight instructions? Well, they're very close to just instructions from the instruction set architecture. So for instance, if you look at the first three here, they're identical to the instructions we had in our ESA, right? But in order to handle prediction and speculation, sometimes in-flight instructions need a bit more information. And I'll illustrate that on control flow instructions. So when we get when we fetch a control flow instruction, we'll have to think about where execution continues. And there are two possible things. One, we might immediately know where execution will continue. For instance, if we have a jump to a constant address, right, then we don't have to speculate. We know where execution will continue. And we'll represent that as an in-flight instruction that is just an assignment to the program counter. But in many cases, we won't know where the branch will go. And we will also represent that as an assignment to the program counter. So at that point, we will guess, we will speculate, we will predict where the branch will go. We'll also write it as an assignment, but we will tag it to indicate that this is a speculation, right? And we will tag it with the address, the code address of the original instruction. So we use that because at some point we will want to check whether we predicted correctly. And by looking back at the original instruction, we can check whether our prediction was correct once we are far enough in the execution. That's the idea. And then there are other in-flight instructions that deal with other kinds of speculation, but I'll explain them as we meet them in the rest of the presentation. Okay, so that's more or less what the state looks like. And again, I will explain the execution, the transitions by example, rather than giving the rules. The rules are a bit more complicated in this case, and you can find details in the papers that I cited. But let's look at an example. So here is a constructed example that shows you how a speculative and out-of-order processor might work. So remember, the execution of a single instruction now is split into fetching it, executing it in the reorder buffer, and committing it, right? That's the idea. So that's what we'll see in this example. So we start this program in an initial state, all register zero, the reorder buffer empty. So now we have to choose whether we'll fetch, execute, or commit. Of course, in the beginning, all we can do is fetch. And so for the sake of the example, let's choose to fetch three instructions. And we're in luck, these are simple instructions, so we can fetch them. And as in-flight instructions, they just are identical to what they were as program instructions, right? So this represents three fetch steps. So now that these instructions are here, the processor can start executing them in whatever order possible, right? And so what do I mean with whatever order possible? Well, the processor will check whether dependencies of an instruction are satisfied, yes or no. And if they're satisfied, that means the instruction can start executing. So for example, this instruction depends on I and N, but I and N will still change. So this is not ready to execute. On the other hand, these two instructions do not depend on anything we don't know yet. So we can start executing them, one of them or both of them in parallel, actually, if we want. Right. So let's assume for the sake of the example that the processor chooses to execute the first one. And this is what happens in this step. So we execute this. And remember, you notice also here, remember what I said, execution does not yet make the results of that execution visible at the architectural level. At the architectural level, it still appears that we haven't started execution of instruction zero. The results are kept in this reorder buffer. But then at some point, we might choose to commit the oldest instruction in the buffer once it's fully executed. So we'll only talk about processors that commit in order. So we can only commit the oldest instruction in the buffer. So here, this is fully executed, so we can commit it. And now the results become visible to the architectural state. Okay, so now we've seen fetch, execute, and commit. Let's fetch another one. So now this is an interesting fetch because this is actually a branch. And so this could go two ways. It could either fall through to four or it could jump to five, right? And it would do that depending on whether R0 is zero, but we don't know yet what R0 will be because R0 is not yet, the final value of R0 is not yet computed, as we see here. So we have to predict, we have to guess, and we'll look at the example where the processor predicts that the branch will be taken, right? And then we get this in-flight instruction. We take the branch, but we remember that this is a prediction and that this prediction was based on instruction on the instruction at address 3. Okay, so now let's look at both things that can happen actually. What if we predict correctly and what if we predict incorrectly? So let's first look at an incorrect prediction. And this is the prediction that we did, that the branch would be taken, will actually turn out to be an incorrect prediction. So let's follow that. So if we predict that execution continues at 5, this is the next instruction we can fetch. And that leaves us with this reorder buffer. And now the processor can again choose what to execute. And one of the choices the processor can make is this instruction here, the last one, all the dependencies are satisfied because I won't change, right? So we can compute this instruction. And that's what happened in this step. And then we could, for example, execute this one and then this one, or maybe even partly in parallel. So that would lead us to this state. And now we can commit these two to the architectural state. And at this point, we can see that this speculation here was wrong, right? So the processor can see, okay, I'm about to commit a speculative jump. I can see that the branch to 5 should have been taken if R0 was 0, but it's not 0, so I was wrong. So what will happen at that point is what is called a rollback. All these intermediate results will be thrown away, and the program counter will be reset to the correct value. So that's what you see here. We lose all these work that we did ahead of time. Now, one thing that I want you to note here that will be important later on is the fact that we have this one instruction here that has been executed, but never made visible to the architectural state, right? So that's what we call a transient execution. The instruction gets executed, but then it gets squashed. It gets thrown away, right? So that's a transient instruction, and that will play an important role in our attacks later on. Let's briefly look at what happens when the prediction is correct. That's less important for security, but this, of course, is why we do predictions, because they might speed things up. So if we predict that the branch would not be taken, so that it falls through, so goes to 4, then we should fetch these two instructions. That's what we do here. And then we can execute, for instance, these two instructions, and then again, these two instructions, and we can commit them. And at this point, when we commit the branch, we can see, we were actually correct. And so we can actually do 3 commits in a row and commit all these things that we computed ahead of time to the architectural state. And this will actually lead to a speed up in the execution of this program, right? And that's why we do all this effort, of course. Okay. So again, I explained you the program states formally. I only explained you the transitions by example. To have the real formal definitions, you should turn to the paper. But one of the things I want to emphasize is that the semantics that you've seen seems to be a bit non-deterministic, right? It requires the processor to make choices. For instance, shall I fetch something or shall I execute something? Is a choice. Or when you make a prediction, how do you make that prediction? How do you choose whether a branch will be taken or not? In real processors, these choices happen based on heuristics and on remembering past behavior. And unfortunately, also that remembering of past behavior, for instance, a history of whether branches have been taken or not, is shared among multiple stakeholders on the platform. As a consequence, these decisions made by the processor can be influenced by an attacker. So we use terms like an attacker can train the branch predictor to predict taken, for example, or poisons the branch predictor to predict taken. So this is clearly something we should model because the attacks essentially rely on that. So let's turn to that. So how can we model the power of the attacker for these kinds of attacks? So there are actually 2 things we should consider. Transient execution attacks rely on 2 important capabilities of the attacker. First, the attacker is able to observe the classic microarchitectural side channels and covert channels that you studied already earlier in this course. So think of cache attacks. There are many more, but it suffices to just think about cache attacks. So we need to model that. And second, we need to model this fact that the attacker can influence the choices that the processor makes during speculative and out-of-order execution. Now, in order to make reasoning about these attacks manageable, and in order to keep our models simple enough, what we will do is over-approximate what the attacker can do and simplify. So this is a challenging exercise. On the one hand, we want to not give the attacker too much power that defenses become impossible. On the other hand, we don't want to model exactly what the attacker can do because it will become enormously detailed. We would have to model the details of caches and branch predictors, and we don't want to do that, right? So what we'll do is over-approximate and simplify for observations. As for the observations the attacker can do, we will use the constant time leakage model that you've seen before, where the attacker essentially learns the control flow and the addresses of memory accesses that happen. And for the influence here, we will give the attacker full control over prediction and scheduling within certain constraints defined in the semantics, and I'll give examples, okay? I want to emphasize that this is great for formal modeling and for reasoning about the attacks, but it significantly simplifies attack examples. So if I give you attack examples, they will look simple. And that is because we have given the attacker quite a bit of power. doing these attacks in real life on a real system can be very tricky and very labor intensive. And if you want to know more about that, I recommend you to read some of the attack papers. There are some beautiful attack papers in this space, but that's not what we'll focus on in this particular presentation. Okay, so let's look at both these aspects of modeling the attacker. First, the constant time leakage model. I think you've seen that, right? So essentially what we'll do is to model the what an attacker can observe, we will turn a transition-based program semantics into a labeled transition-based program semantics, where the labels will essentially say what the attacker could worst case observe about this step of the execution. And we'll follow the constant time, the simplest version of the constant time leakage model here, where the control flow leaks. So at each step, the program counter will leak and addresses of memory accesses leak. So whenever there's a memory access, like this memory access here, then the actual address that's being accessed also leaks, right? And so this is a nice and clean and simple model. It over approximates what an attacker can learn. It might be really tricky in real life to adequately monitor the control flow of a program, but we know that it can be done. So let's just give the attacker this power by means of this label. I should say that in later examples, whenever we rely on the fact that things will leak through this constant time leakage model, I will make this very often explicit by writing a leak pseudo instruction. So when I write leak and then some expression, a secret expression, you should think of this as any code that would leak this secret to a microarchitectural side channel. So for example, you could expand this to a load from address secret, or you could expand it to a jump to code address secret, or there are many other snippets you could choose. But I will use this just to make very explicit where we will leak things to an attacker observing the microarchitecture. Okay, so far for the constant time leakage model. So what about influence on the execution? So the way in which we will handle that is, we will define the semantics in such a way that there is some non-determinism. So there is some choice on what the next step will be, but within certain constraints, right? So for example, fetching is only possible if there's room in the reorder buffer, or executing an instruction is only possible if all the dependencies are satisfied, or committing is only possible for the oldest instruction and only after it has completely executed, right? So the semantics will be non-deterministic to some extent, but it will impose constraints on what circumstances does it make sense to do a fetch and execute or a commit step, right? But then among these constrained choices, we will give the attacker complete freedom to choose what to do. And here's an example on the example we looked at before. So this is the execution we looked at before. And I'm showing here all the steps that are possible according to the semantics. So for instance, in the initial state, all you can do is fetch. There's nothing yet to execute. There's nothing to commit. So the attacker has to choose. That's the yellow arrow, has to choose to do a fetch. But in this state, there is some choice. We could fetch more instructions. There's still room in the reorder buffer. Or we could execute this one or this one. And we can't execute this one because dependencies are not satisfied. So the attacker has three choices. And in this particular execution, the attacker has chosen to execute the zeroth instruction. Okay. And then in that next step, the attacker can again choose to fetch, can choose to commit this one, or can choose to execute the load at this point, right? And in our example execution, he chose to do a commit, and that's what we see here. And now also predictions will be given to the attacker will be given the power to choose predictions, right? So when we fetch this particular branch here. So now if we would fetch the branch at address 3, we see that this will require a prediction. So we let the attacker choose between fetching and predicting taken for the branch or fetching and predicting not taken for the branch. And in this case, in this example here, the attacker chooses the first option, fetch and predict taken. Okay, I hope this clarifies how we model the power of the attacker to influence predictions and choices made by the processor during out-of-order execution. I should also mention that this means, of course, when we prove stuff about the processors modeled like this, if we want to prove something is secure, we should now consider all possible choices that the attacker could make. So when we prove security, we should prove it for all possible choices that the attacker could make. Okay, so now we are ready to look at actual attacks. So we have a full model. We have a model of the processor. We have a model of the attacker. So let's look at what these attacks look like. So the main insight of transient execution attacks is that we can use these transient executions that I mentioned. So these instructions that get executed and then get squashed. So it appears to software that they never executed, but they actually did execute. And this impacts security in two ways. So first, these transiently executed instructions, they can also leak information on microarchitectural side channels. Right? So that's just an empirical fact. Right. So when they are squashed, when they are rolled back, the architectural effects are discarded, but any microarchitectural effects that the instruction had remain. So if the instruction loaded something from memory and put it in the cache as a consequence, then that impact on the cache is not undone, that remains. So as a consequence, transiently executed instructions leak information to the attacker. And that's weird because from the software point of view, these instructions are never executed. Right? And yet they leak information. So that's one point. The second point is that transiently executed instructions can access information that you would expect not to be accessible. And this can happen in two ways. First, you expect the information not to be accessible because you have software checks in place. But unfortunately, instructions that are executed out of order and squashed maybe instructions that you could never reach in an actual program path. It might be that a certain check that you do in a conditional branch is not checked before doing a certain instruction. And that leads to Spectre-style attacks, and we'll give a couple of examples of those. Even more surprising, sometimes transiently executed instructions can even access information in other hardware protection domains. So a user-level program might access information in the kernel, or one virtual machine might access information belonging to another virtual machine. And that's what meltdown-style attacks do, and we'll also look at an example of those. Okay, so let's look at examples. First, Spectre. Spectre is, I think, the most interesting one. I'll explain why later. So I'll look at two or three examples, depending on how we do on time. They're a bit tricky, but on the other hand, I hope you already have seen some of them. I think you've seen some of them even in this course. But not in order to make sure that you see what's going on, it's good to keep the following big picture in mind. Right. So in each example, I will show you a small piece of machine code that operates on a program state containing secrets. And I will mark the secrets that I care about in red on the slide so that you know where the secrets are. And then you should check for yourself that the code snippets I give you do not leak these secrets. They do not leak them architecturally, and they even do not leak them taking into account, let's say, the classic cache-based or general microarchitectural side channel. In fact, all the examples I will show you will satisfy the constant time coding discipline. So up to 2018, they would have been considered perfectly secure, right? And then I'll show you, based on the semantics and the attacker model that we discussed, how speculation and out-of-order execution can still cause the secrets to leak. That's what all the examples will do, okay? So let's look first at Spectre V1, the one you've seen before. So hopefully that is a relatively simple one. So what do we have here? This is the program state, right? This is the memory. We have an array in there of length 2, and we store the length right before the array. We assume that the contents of the array itself are public. We don't care that these contents leak. But somewhere else in memory, there's a secret. I put it at address 3. We could put it anywhere. It doesn't matter. The secret value 1234 here. And then we have a piece of code. Here you have pseudocode, and here you have the actual code in our model of the instruction set architecture that will access an element of this array, and it will do it under a bounds check such that we know that we're only accessing actual public values, right? And out of bounds access is not possible architecturally. And then it will do something that will leak the red value to the architectural, to the microarchitectural state, right? This is one of these leak gadgets I mentioned. So this is fine. This is constant time code because it doesn't even ever read a secret, right? It doesn't touch a secret, right? So clearly, from an architectural point of view, this code is fine. What gets leaked is only public information. But so here's what happens when we execute this on our processor model. So let's start in an initial state where A points indeed to the array, and where the index I for instance, provided through input, maybe by the attacker, is indeed out of bounds, right? So A2 will actually point to the secret. How will this be executed? Well, first we will fetch all the instructions. That's what happens here. And of course, since we have a branch here, this requires a prediction. Here you see a speculated branch. And the attacker will choose to mispredict. So we will know that actually the branch here will be taken, yeah, because the access will be out of bounds. 2 is not strictly smaller than 2. But the attacker will mispredict. And as a consequence, these two instructions will be fetched. And I expanded the leak here into a load from the address R0. Okay. So now the processor can execute these instructions in any way allowed by the semantics. So for instance, it can execute this one because it has no dependencies that are unsatisfied, and it can execute this one. And that's what happens here. We first execute the first instruction here, and then we execute this instruction, and we see as a consequence that we have a load from address 1, 2, 3, 4. So we leak this address through the constant time leakage model to an attacker observing the microarchitectural state. Okay. And of course, further down the execution, we will notice, oh, this prediction was wrong. And these two instructions will be squashed. So they are transient instructions, but it's too late. The sending of the secret on the microarchitectural channel already has happened. Right. So this is Spectre V1 in our model. You saw it before in a slightly different setting. So let's look at another one. So here is Spectre V2, we exploit computed jumps here. So here we have again a memory state. This is where the secret is. I've chosen an arbitrary memory address to contain a secret. And we have a snippet of code that architecturally is perfectly secure, right? So it will load the secret. It will load a function pointer from address 8, and let's assume that address 8 contains 20. So that would mean that we execute this function. So we jump to the function, and the function is completely harmless. It overrides the secret with 0 and jumps back. And I realize that an actual function call is a bit more complicated, but I try to simplify to the maximal extent possible. So we jump to this trusted function, and then after we return, all is fine. All that happened is that the secret has been cleared and nothing would have leaked to the microarchitectural state. And again, according to the constant time model, this would be secure code. However, what can happen on a speculative processor? So let's fetch these instructions, right? When we fetch this instruction here, this jump, we don't know yet what this function pointer will resolve to, right? This load might take a bit of time. So the processor might predict where this jump will go, and we give the attacker the choice of where the jump should go. And the attacker will look in memory, in code memory, for a gadget that will leak the contents of our register R0, right? So for instance, he finds such a gadget at address 31. So he predicts, he influences the prediction here to go to address 31. And then if we execute this, we can first execute the first load, even commit it. So this code is actually computing on the secret as opposed to Spectre V1. And next we could choose to execute this instruction, which would indeed broadcast again. So we would access memory at address R0, which is address 1, 2, 3, 4, which means the address is broadcasted on a microarchitectural side channel and leaks to the attacker. And of course, again, later on, when we catch up, we'll notice that this prediction is wrong. It should have been 20, not 31, and everything will be rolled back. So again, this is a transient instruction, but it's too late. The secret has leaked. Yeah, so this is a second example of how information. Maybe keeping an eye on the time, let's skip the third example so that I have time left for meltdown and for defenses. There are many more of these variants. And let me just point you to transient.fail, the site I mentioned before, which has this classification tree, and where for each of the variants, for instance, this is what transient.fail gives you for Spectre V1, you find a brief description as well as detailed references for technical details about each of the variants of the attack. So what I do want you to remember and look at is the devastating nature of this kind of attack on software-enforced confidentiality properties. I mean, Professor Loa emphasized at the end of his lecture today how difficult it is to reason about confidentiality. Well, even if with relational logic we would have reasoned about information leaks from the programs that we looked at, if we would reason at the level of instruction set architecture abstraction, we would not see any leaks, and yet on a real system they do leak. Right. So this is really, from the point of view of enforcing confidentiality, a devastating attack. Let's briefly look at Meltdown. So Meltdown is different. Surprisingly, so Meltdown is more of a bug than a design flaw, I would say. It turns out that in some processors, a much smaller set of processors than for Spectre, but in some processors, when you do a memory load, that will raise a fault, an exception, right? So a page fault or a protection fault, security exception. That on some processors, well, clearly that exception will happen on commit of an instruction. And some processors will allow to execute the load transiently anyway. Even if it will fault on commit, it will execute out of order, and the results of the load may actually be forwarded to later transient instructions, right? So of course, architecturally, it doesn't matter, because at the point where this instruction would be committed, it would fault and everything stops. So this would never be executed architecturally. But as we've seen, even transient leaks matter. And so this is really the essence of Meltdown. What you do is, in user mode, you load from an address that you don't have the right to read. You read from a kernel address. That will, of course, raise a protection fault. But transiently, you can actually read and broadcast this value on a microarchitectural side channel. And then after the exception has been handled, you can read from the microarchitectural side channel and get the secret. And this is how Meltdown succeeded in reading kernel memory from user mode. So later papers have shown that this is actually even trickier than it looks. There are many conditions under which these faulting loads compute transiently on all kinds of potentially sensitive data, and that's the three of Meltdown attacks, and I won't go into them, as I think there's something that will be fixed in hardware eventually. I think this is something that can be fixed purely in hardware and that we might be able to forget as programmers in a couple of years. But if you want to know more, transient.fail again has the full tree of known attacks with, again, descriptions and references for all the attacks that matter. Okay, so let me jump. I see I have 10 minutes left, so let me jump to defenses to make sure that we have some time to say something about defenses. So I think it's clear when you see what the attacks can do that defenses were necessary before these vulnerabilities were disclosed. And so people have worked on defenses right away, and defenses have been implemented, deployed, and investigated at multiple levels, and sometimes a bit in an ad hoc way. For instance, there are already Meltdown-resistant processors out. So Intel has fixed the Meltdown bug in hardware. There's no really good reason that I see. Probably there are reasons that I don't know for forwarding these values from faulting loads. Other processors also don't do it. So this is something that we can probably expect to go away after a while. But of course, there are many processors that were still vulnerable, and for these we've seen mitigations in the operating system. So for instance, a simple defense against Meltdown would be to make sure that kernel memory is not addressable from user space. So you place the kernel in a separate virtual address space, and that's a mitigation that all the major operating systems have done in 2018. And more for Spectre, you can also do mitigations in the compiler. For instance, you can insert instructions to stop out of order execution, or you can rewrite code to remove the vulnerability. So I'll give examples of those in a minute. I'll focus on Spectre defenses here because, as I said, I think this will go away eventually. So let's look at Spectre defenses. It makes sense to first ask ourselves, what should be the objective of these defenses, right? So when is a defense okay? When is a defense secure? Right? And it should not be a surprise to this audience that since transient execution attacks cause unexpected information flows, we will use information flow security techniques to define security here. So the most general definition, we could take a policy to be an equivalence relation over program states, where that equivalence relation is intended to capture the notion of indistinguishability, what you want to be indistinguishable to an attacker, right? A simple instance of that is you mark certain parts of the program state as secret, like I did with the red memory cells. And then the equivalence relation is two program states should be indistinguishable if they only differ in secrets. So if all the public parts are the same, but secrets are different, then it should not be possible for an attacker to distinguish these two states. And I'll actually only use the simple notion of policy further on. So you might ask, why should we not make all program states indistinguishable, right? So why not make everything secret, which would mean that this equivalence relation really is the relation that relates any program state to any program state. Well, that might make sense. That would say that you care about absolute secrecy. The problem is that for such a strong policy, we don't know how to do that and maintain reasonable performance, right? So that's why we want to study also situations where only part of the program state is secret. And now we can say that a program P is secure on a hardware processor H if executing that program on that processor, starting from two equivalent initial states, so two states that are supposed to be indistinguishable, will indeed produce identical observations for the attacker. So the things that are supposed to be indistinguishable will indeed, for that program and on that processor, not be distinguishable for the attacker. Right. So that's our definition of security. And clearly, you can now achieve security by working on P. So you could rewrite your program, or the compiler could rewrite your program, or by working on H. You could make the processor more secure, or a combination of both. So let's see this definition at work, and let's see some defenses at work. So here is again the Spectre V1 example that you saw before. I just want to show you that this program on the processor that we modeled is indeed insecure. Why? Well, so here's the program state. Two program states will be equivalent if they are identical on the non-red parts and they differ in the red part. So maybe one program state has 1, 2, 3, 4 and the other has 6, 6, 6, 6. Well, then it's clear that if we consider these two executions on these two different program states, that they will be different for the attacker, because the attacker will see 1, 2, 3, 4 here in one execution and 6, 6, 6 in the other execution, right? So clearly, the example we gave is not secure on the processor we formalized. So how can we fix this? So there are different approaches being explored. So one way is to harden the program by making sure that even on misspeculated paths, the indices into this array are inbounds, right? So the problem really is that you check in software that an index is inbounds, but on a misspeculated path, it might still go out of bounds, right? So what we do is we add code. So for instance, we can clip the index to be between 0 and len-1, right, with this modulo operation. On an architectural path, on a correctly predicted path, this will be a no-op. It doesn't do anything. If I is between 0 and len-1, this doesn't do anything. But on a misspeculated path, it will, even in the out-of-order execution, make sure that I is between 0 and len-1. And that's what you see in this execution. So you see the additional instruction that does the clipping here. And so these two instructions, since this one depends on I and this one depends on R0, will only be executed after this one. And this one will make sure that I is always within bounds. And as a consequence, we see that indeed no out-of-bounds information leaks to the attacker. And this program on our original processor that we modeled is indeed secure. An alternative thing we could do is provide some hardware support. So the processor could provide an instruction that we didn't model, but it's easy to extend our model to have such instructions. And actually, most processors had instructions that did exactly this for reasons of memory ordering rather than security. So we can extend the processor with a fence instruction. What the fence instruction does is it blocks out-of-order execution. So essentially, you can't execute in the reorder buffer. You're not allowed to execute instructions behind the fence, essentially. And clearly, you can use that to make this program secure, right? If right after a branch that you worry about might be misspeculated, if you put a fence, then even on a misspeculated path, this fence here will make sure that these transient instructions will not be scheduled for execution, right? So since this fence will not never commit, right, it will be squashed at the point where this misprediction is detected, the fence will always be in the reorder buffer, and these instructions, while these instructions are in there, and these instructions will never be executed, so there is no leak. And again, we now satisfy this program on the extended processor with support for fencing is now secure. Okay. So that gives you an idea of how people are coming up with defenses and proving them. It's interesting to say that this is actually a very intricate problem that has many facets. And I want to illustrate that briefly as the last part of the talk. So defenses will actually have to deal with quite different kinds of attack scenarios. It's interesting to think about the attacks that we've seen and to think about them as consisting of two steps. So in the attacks, we've always seen that the processor at some point accesses a secret, gets it into a register, and a bit later leaks it through a microarchitectural side channel. Right? So now we can distinguish three scenarios. First one is both the access and the leak are non-transient. So they happen architecturally on a correctly predicted path. That's actually a classic side channel attack, right? So you read a secret into a register, and then you use that to index into an array, for instance. And this is something we knew, and that can be defended with constant time programs. So that's not interesting from our point of view. Then you have the scenario where the access is non-transient, but the leak is transient. We had that in our Spectre V2, for example. So this is a case where the software is expected to compute on secrets, and we just want to make sure that the secrets do not get broadcasted to microarchitectural channels. And so this, you can think of this essentially as an extension of the constant time problem, right? So we want to come up with programming disciplines for programs that, like cryptographic code that manipulate secrets, to make sure that if you program in that way, the secrets will not leak. And there's yet a third kind of scenario, a scenario in which both the access and the leak are transient. And Spectre V1 was an example of that. So this is an even more vexing scenario where your code architecturally is never even touching secrets, yet it's accessing and broadcasting them transiently. And this is tricky because this can happen in scenarios where you have untrusted code, right? So a typical scenario is a sandboxing scenario where some victim host program executes attacker code using some kind of software-based isolation mechanism. A typical example would be a browser running WebAssembly code, right? And this is tricky because now the attacker can bring code. So the attacker can try to bring code that will give him access and leak gadgets that will be executed transiently, right? So this is somewhat harder to protect against in the sense that the attacker can bring code here, whereas this is code that a trusted developer writes. On the other hand, it's also a bit easier because here we know that the program is never supposed to access secrets, whereas here it's actually very normal for a program to access secrets. But the fact that we know that programs shouldn't access secrets here gives us maybe easier security objectives. Like, for instance, a sufficient condition for security is to make the processor ensure that transiently accessed data never leaks. So if we make sure that transiently accessed data never leaks, well, since architecturally accessed data is never secret in this scenario, this is enough, whereas this is not enough in this scenario, okay? So I'm sketching the various scenarios just to kind of give you a feeling, an intuition for the complexity of coming up with defenses. We have to deal with performance, and we have to deal with quite different scenarios and attacker models, actually, okay? So with that, unfortunately, I'm at the end of my seminar. So as a brief conclusion, I hope I convinced you that these transient execution attacks are an interesting and fundamentally new class of attacks. They break many important security mechanisms. They break process isolation, virtual machine isolation, logical software-based isolation, and so forth. I hope I've shown that they're not easy to defend against. Well, they're easy to defend against, but not while maintaining good performance properties. There are plenty of short-term defenses, and they are useful, but they're also a bit ad hoc. And we already see the first attack papers breaking the first wave of defenses. And I'm sure this will continue for a while, where we see other ad hoc defenses that are again being broken. I think there is a very interesting research field here towards long-term defenses. So clearly against Spectre, we don't know what to do about Spectre in hardware yet. Pure software defenses will remain important for the foreseeable future, even if Spectre-resistant, whatever that means, processors come up in the future. We will be dealing with Spectre-vulnerable processors for at least 10 years in the future. So pure software defenses are very important, and this is a very active research domain, and there's next month at SMP a very nice systematization of knowledge paper that if you want to know more, you can dive into. But I think in the long run, we will need to go to hardware-software co-designs. So probably the hardware will have to give us something, will have to do something, or the software will have to tell the hardware more about what is secret and what it expects the hardware to do. So these are hardware-software co-designs. And again, this is an area that's being explored by a whole research community at the moment. And if you want to dive into this, there was a great paper at SMP last year, won the best paper award, actually, by Marco Guarnieri et al. On a framework to reason about these kinds of co-designs. So he has a formal framework where he defines a notion of contract between hardware and software that can be used to reason about these designs, and he gives some security proofs for some of these co-designs, for example. Okay, so unfortunately, I could only give you kind of a teaser of the field, but I hope I also giving you pointers to where to find more information. And I see I'm already a couple of minutes over time. So with that, I will stop.
Thanks a lot, Frank. That was very instructive.